to resist.
Yes.
Well, this is where things get pretty nasty.
Violent extremist groups linked to the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda have become a major security concern in the central Sahel area of West Africa. In the eye of the storm are Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger Republic, particularly the tri-border region between these countries. Their presence has amplified threats to civilians, which has led to the deaths of thousands of people and the displacement of many more. The situation in the volatile region is further complicated by the political crisis in some of the countries, in addition to poor governance and livelihood opportunities. How much of the security trends and the difficult socioeconomic conditions of the people is being exploited by extremist groups? What's the relationship between frontline communities and these groups? Hello, welcome to The Crisis Room, a podcast from Human Angle. I'm Hawassa Al-Abakar and I'm here with my colleague Murtala Abdullahi. In this podcast, we look at crisis trends across the country and answer the tough questions around them. This week, we're here with a guest, Ivan Gishawa, a senior lecturer at the University of Kent and one of the authors of the recent published study on the interactions between civilians and jihadists in Mali and Niger. Good day, Ivan. Welcome to The Crisis Room. Can you tell us more about what's happening currently in the Sahel region? Our listeners will also want to understand the region itself and the actors.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really, really honored to be with you today. And I'm a great fan of everything you publish. So I have like two big reasons to be happy today, to be among people whose work I really, really admire. So this report is based on surveys that have been conducted in the central Sahel, in Niger, in the western part of the country, in the Tillabéri region, and in central Mali. And the reason or the main motive behind this report is to figure out, in a way, the kind of social contract that may prevail in places where the jihadists are, in fact, the strongest political and military force. That does not mean that the state has completely disappeared, but the jihadists are strong enough to impose their will on the population. So we really wanted to explore how civilians respond to these situations, and to see whether some sort of stable pact can be established between the jihadists, who we see very much as political actors, and the civilians and their representatives. Now, the reason why we started this research is because, of course, the jihadist movements have entrenched in the central Sahel, and this has started in fact, long time ago. But you may consider 2012 the main date for the expansion of jihadist groups. 2012 is when the separatist movements from northern Mali started a rebellion. They eventually kicked out the state from most of its strongholds in northern Mali. Now, ironically, these separatist movements somehow lost steam and were eventually crowded out by jihadists. And for about a year, jihadist groups took control of northern Mali. After 1 year, they were driven out by the French intervention in 2013. The French intervention helped the Malian forces reconquer the main urban centers. But the jihadists didn't disappear completely. They somehow entrenched in rural areas. And they haven't disappeared since then. And they have even expanded their influence. They are now extremely influential in Burkina Faso and in Niger. And of course, now more lately, in the northern part of the coastal countries. So the report was based on the following idea. how do we explain this expansion? And the main hypothesis was, well, in fact, it's not just the military might that allows jihadist groups to gain so much influence and territorial control. It's also their capacity to deal with local situations and perhaps negotiate some form of settlement with civilians. So this is the background of the report, basically.
The situation in the region seems to be quite volatile. How much of the political, social, and economic problems enabled this crisis?
Yeah, that's one of the big debates around the expansion of jihadism, whether the causes have to do with the local political economy, or whether the causes are religious, or whether the causes are political. Well, in fact, there's no single explanation for the expansion of the jihadist movements. In the case of Central Mali, for example, there has been plenty of works already showing how the pastoralist economy is central to the expansion of jihadist movements, in the sense that you had all sorts of dynamics in the post-colonial era that somehow privileged sedentary groups at the expense of pastoralist communities. And now the jihadists are somehow offering an opportunity to certain categories of people who have been aggrieved by these modes of governance to take a revenge against state actors who they see as their oppressors and the reasons for their marginalization. So that is something that is happening in Central Mali. But you need also to be more nuanced, more careful, and look really at the special circumstances of like every place where eventually jihadist groups entrenched. So pastoralism and issues around pastoralism, access to land, might be a very, very powerful driver for jihadist expansion in Central Mali. But perhaps at the border between Mali and Niger, the situation is slightly different. It may have to do with tensions among pastoralist groups. It may have to do with past conflicts that were essentially communal conflicts that have not been addressed comprehensively. So, and again, the jihadists are very good sociologists. That's a claim that we make. They read the social environment very, very well, and they are able to activate the right language so that some communities, at least, or some segments of certain aggrieved communities eventually join their ranks. Now, they are also, of course, using coercion and violence. We need to be very clear about this. It's not just through seduction that the groups manage to gain territory. It's also through violence. And in the case of Niger, the Islamic State, the local branch of the Islamic State, is using violence in a way that is very extreme and that literally does not leave much choice to the populations, because the state is not there to permanently protect the populations. So also the state presence is too thin, is too weak, and is not permanent enough, which means that most of the day, most of the week, in fact, the populations are immediately confronted with the jihadist presence. They don't see the state very often. So that means that the jihadists have a sort of upper hand. They can make populations do what they want them to do.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, and you kind of like moved into some of the questions I had for you. So you actually mirrored a lot in terms of what's happening in the Sahel, and I like the fact that you also really explained the history of the situation, especially more in terms of when we're looking at when the Tuareg rebellion happened and a huge chunk of Mali fell under the the French had to come in and support to claim some of these areas. That we've also seen what happened between the Tuaregs and the other groups, the jihadist group in which they were in bed with, and then things happened along the way. And then successors of some of the groups that became the JNIM and also the Islamic State. Then also we have seen changes in terms of security structure, the French having to pull out from Mali. But I think for me, really an interesting thing that you mentioned was in terms of the socialist tendency, like the ability of the jihadists to understand and play with the local population. And so, and it's something that your research really looked at, what's the nature of this relationship within the local population, because you're talking something around the pastoralists and how that is intertwined with what the problem in the region. So I just want to get more in terms of what the nature of the relationship between the local population and these jihadist groups.
Thank you. Yes. So I will focus on the case of Central Mali, because the case of Western Niger and the border between Niger and Mali, where the Islamic State operates, is slightly different. It's a sort of extreme case where it's essentially violence that is used to make populations comply. So that's in fact a finding of the report, that the nature of the contract that exists between the jihadists and the civilians in the western part of Niger is in fact a very, very weak contract. We wanted to operationalize this idea by looking specifically at the Islamic tax that jihadists call like the zakat, but in fact Islamic clerics like might contest the use of the word zakat for what the jihadists are doing in the area, because zakat, of course, is supposed to be a redistributive mechanism. But in the case of Western Niger, the jihadists come, they ask villages, give us like this amount of cows, and they eventually extract riches, wealth from the population, but the wealth never goes back. It's never distributed to the poor. Whereas in Central Mali, the zakat, or what the jihadists call the zakat, is eventually returned to the populations or to the poor segments of the populations in a fairly codified way. And so even though we have one word, zakat, in the case of, or in the two cases, like the word designates two very different realities, right? So in the case of Central Mali, there is a sort of minimal political agreement or social contract built around the zakat, because there is some redistribution toward the poor, built around the delivery of certain services in the form of the judiciary, for example. So the jihadists would adjudicate conflicts, in particular land conflicts between pastoralists and farmers, or among pastoralists. And then there's another dimension which we highlight in the report. It's how marriage is being handled. We noticed, and other scholars have also made the same observation, that, for example, in Central Mali, the dowry, like what families pay for marrying their kids, has been capped, right? So that young people have greater chance to get married with each other. And so it's a sort of democratization of marriage that the jihadists have offered. Of course, they are also reconfiguring gender relationships. I mean, there are all sorts of aspects of life that make the jihadist rule relatively accountable, and in some occasions even more legitimate than what the state is offering. And so let me just add one little thing, is that the value of jihadist order in the eyes of the population is not established necessarily on the basis of the what the jihadists offer intrinsically. It's based on the comparison between what the jihadists offer and what the state offer. And this comparative element is absolutely essential, because even in situations where people don't necessarily love the jihadist presence, you can still find situations where people prefer the jihadist to what the state is doing, because the state has a reputation of being a very extractive and predatory actor.
A lot of what the research findings in terms of what's happening in central Mali are things that you can say, oh, it's almost similar to the Lake Chad, or it's almost similar to what we have in the Mozambique, those kind of places. So it's kind of looked like, oh, when the state is failing, jihadists then kind of step in to do some of the things that the state cannot or is not doing. And again, the jihadists trying to manipulate the local economy. And what I mean by local economy, both the people and the natural resources that are there, whether in terms of land, water, access to these things, as we've also seen in the Lake Chad Basin, provision of services like even judiciary, adjudication of matters that affect the lives of people. So this, I think for me, it's kind of like brings a lot of insight into what can be done. But I think Hawa will be asking that question later. But my question is, so when you look at the social contract, it's not like, yeah, it may be like some sort of soft approach a lot, but what happens when people try to resist?
To resist?
Yes.
Well, this is where things get pretty nasty. In fact, and that's another big element of the report, when some consistent resistance is happening, then we see jihadists like unleashing atrocious forms of violence. And one form of violence that has become almost systematic across all the cases that we have reviewed is the technique of the siege. It's like literally starvation, using starvation as a weapon of war. So they organize blockades of villages. They don't let anyone enter or go out, which means eventually like no more economic activities are happening. And that can last for months and months and months. And this is very much associated often with targeted killings. Individuals who are considered informants of the state or enemy within the community are also systematically eliminated. And we also had reports or testimonies about killings of cattle, for example. Like, and, I mean, there have been like viral videos circulating that we have seen where, for example, one village that had started a militia, a self-defense militia, had seen like not just the militiamen like eliminated like physically, but also all the horses of the village killed. So that's the probably the most harrowing aspect, in the sense that the jihadists come, they approach villages, they tell them, well, you have to comply with the Sharia law, men have to grow their beard, etc. They deliver their sort of playbook. Yeah. If populations don't accept this, then that can turn like very, very nasty, very, very quickly. And this is where the state has a major role to play, because sometimes the state lets civilians believe that they can receive assistance if they resist. But if the state's promise is not credible, you could still see some resistance emerging, people being slaughtered, and state assistance like eventually never come. And so this is where the state should be very, very cautious with the kind of hopes that it gives to the population who may have some willingness to respond. We haven't found a situation where the resistance in fact was strong enough to confront the jihadists credibly. We only have like absolutely tragic stories of populations that started a militia, a self-defense group, and that were eventually completely crushed and slaughtered.
You just highlighted something important. When people want to resist, And when the authorities give the signal that when you resist, we'll be there for you, the authorities need to be there for them.
From this conversation, it is clear that a military and non-military approach is needed in order to address this problem. What are your recommendations for peace building as you found out in the study?
That's an excellent question, and this is a tricky one that generally, like scholars, academics, like don't like, because we're good at raising critiques, but we're probably less good at designing viable policy recommendations. What we try to do in the report is that we consider that some very limited ambitions should be considered. And one of them being the protection of civilians. So we basically suggest what you just said, Awa, that a range of military and non-military actions might be needed, but with a sort of principle in mind, which is do no harm, which is a very classic principle in the fields of development, counterinsurgency, whatever. But let's make sure that whatever we do is not going to cause more harm to populations. And I can give you an example, an illustration of this point, which is based on the testimony of one of the people that have been interviewed as part of this research. And in fact, I need to mention that the report is full of quotes. Like, we really wanted to have many, many quotes in this report. And this person says, look, we want the state back, but if it's just a patrol here and there, we prefer not to have the state at all. Because what happens if the state comes, visits the village, asks questions to villagers, and then leaves, like the next day, everyone who was seen talking to the military patrol is going to be into trouble, kidnapped, sometimes killed, tortured. So that's the big, I think, conundrum and difficult equation for the state. If the state wants to come back, it needs to be back with credible force and also with a credible political agenda, political project for the populations. Because of course, all of what is happening does not come from nowhere, right? It's built on grievances, anger, and it's built on decades of misgovernance by state actors.
Thank you for sharing these important insights with us, and we look forward to having you again. This is an episode of Human Angle Crisis Room. Join us in 2 weeks for another episode.